Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. And today I'm welcomed by two wonderful fine gentlemen who are here in studio with me, which for the first time, this is having my co-host and my guest in the studio. It's something new for Sourcing Matters. So I'm quite excited to have you gentlemen. Thank you for partaking. First is my co-host, John Della Volpe. Hey, John, how you doing?
I'm great.
So John is the founder of Social Sphere. He's also the director of polling at the Harvard Kennedy School IOP. And he's a globally recognized expertise in understanding the sentiment of millennials. Sentient animals is something different. Sentiment is very different in itself. So, John, what does that mean? What do you do with the IOP? And can you tell us a little about what's going on with millennials?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, Aaron. And I think of myself as being kind of embedded with millennials, you know. So millennials work at Social Sphere. I have three at home with me while they're in college now. One just graduated. And for almost 20 years now, I've been working with about two dozen undergraduates at Harvard College every semester to study and understand the opinions of the world's largest generation, the millennial generation. So we conduct a public opinion survey every single semester. We analyze it with the students, and we go out and we report the findings to elected officials, to stakeholders, to academics, think tanks, members of the media, with the overall objective to kind of break down the barrier between traditional institutions and young people. If traditional institutions understand what's on the minds of young people, ideally, they can communicate more effectively and increase civic participation, dialogue, and ultimately voting.
I'm sure that with your three kids in the late teens and 20s, no matter how much you're recognized as a global expert, a bit like how President Obama would say, you're still dad and you can embarrass the hell out of them, no problem, right?
Especially on Twitter, yes.
Yeah, there you
especially
go.
On Twitter.
So, John, one thing I'd like to mention about millennials, quite interesting and especially apropos for our conversation, is two macro trends that seem to be associated with them are their interest in food and also their interest in environmental issues.
Without question, young people care deeply about flexibility. When we think about how they think about the world and the American dream, it's everything is about kind of flexibility. And I think, apropos of the conversation today, the degree to which young people can create opportunities for others to be flexible with food, when we think about local farms, and they want to feel good about the things that they buy, invest in, work with, etc. So the degree to which those folks in kind of the food and beverage industry can kind of tell the story of why it's important, why it's healthy, why it's sustainable, and provide options and flexibility. That's something that kind of young people kind of relate to, very, very well.
Yeah, and the key driver of authenticity underpinning much of that too. So I want to jump into our conversation with our guest, Chris Sherman, who's the president of Island Creek Oysters. Chris, thanks for joining.
Happy to be here.
So Chris, let me share this quick anecdote, which is quite fun. I'd like to throw those little stories in here. I was reading a book this weekend with my son, and that's not the story. I was actually just throwing that in there. But I was reading a book called The 1,000 Facts of Science with my nine-year-old, and we're reading this interesting anecdote that the oldest animal on Earth, believe it or not, is a quahog, a North Atlantic quahog, which on average can live up to 200 years. It's pretty phenomenal in itself. But I read that in the 1990s, they found a quahog that was 500 years old. So if you think about that, that when Columbus was sailing the ocean blue, he stepped across this quahog living here in the North Atlantic, which cues us up nicely for our conversation about bivalves today. So, John, this is, you know Chris as well, and it's exciting what we've seen happen here within the food movement in the Northeast. And a lot of that comes down to the enthusiasm and excitement we're seeing within the fisheries and our ocean farmers. And a lot of credit can go to what's happened from Island Creek Oysters. Chris, you have been with Island Creek Oysters for a while. You're president of the firm. You've seen quite evolution happen over a great period of time. And what I find interesting, what you guys do, is you've evolved oyster production to become a bit like what the winemakers in Napa have done or the whiskey makers in Scotland have done, maybe even throwing it in with a bit of a lifestyle brand of like what Patagonia and Filson have done, which is pretty unique here. You got a lifestyle correlated with what's going on with food and enthusiasm, excitement behind that food and the provenance, assurance of quality. That's really unique, what we've seen in happening with getting to know your farmer and know your farm. And it's happening within our fisheries, which again is unique. So maybe you could share with us a bit of what you're doing at Island Creek Oysters and a little bit of your lineage as a company and where your plans are in the next few years.
Sure, happy to. I should come clean also and say that I found out more recently than I care to admit that I actually am a millennial.
Also, own it, own it.
It just skirted in the early 80s there. So, you know, it's funny, John, that you mentioned, you know, the storytelling aspect of it, and you as well, Aaron. You know, a lot of our success in our ability to, you know, market our product, which obviously is a prerequisite, you know, to growing food as a business, is you can't grow something you can't sell, or like go out of business relatively fast. And telling that story and kind of coupling it with the lifestyle that you mentioned, you know, we were fortunate enough to, many of us at Island Creek, to grow up in Duxbury, where the farm is, and kind of had this amazing lifestyle. And I don't think any of us really realized it, you know, with this connection to the water, to the heritage of the place, you know, dating back from the landing of the Mayflower to the shipbuilding and the kind of the creation of this country. You know, there's this incredible industrial heritage there tied in with the coast. When we started kind of bringing that out alongside the oysters, we had this tremendous positive feedback, and a lot of the people whom it resonated with were the millennial crowd, you know, people who wanted something more than just the food on their plate in front of them. They wanted to know kind of where it came from, who are the people who grew it, and that became clear to us pretty early on. And a big part of what we did was, you know, it differentiated us from some of the other early adopters in this shellfish farming movement here in New England, was to really bring that story to light and right in kind of in front of the noses of the people who are consuming the product.
I would say that, Chris, in many ways, you are the prototypical millennial, especially kind of in the workplace, because all of our surveys indicate that above even kind of financial reward, the ability to do something you can be proud of every single day is a key driver. So, and I know you've provided a lot of opportunities for other millennials younger than you to have that same opportunity as well.
Yeah, that's a big thing that, you know, I speak for myself and also for our founder, Skip Bennett, who actually started, you know, Skip likes to say that Island Creek was a overnight success, 25 years in the making. He is not a millennial. He's, you know, older than I am, but he, you know, kind of picked up on that at a very early stage and has really infused the company and our culture with this notion that, you know, obviously the mission of the business is this concept of triple bottom line. You know, there's the profit that you have to make to exist. You know, there's the, but there's also coupling that with the social good that it creates. And our commitment to staff and the people that work for us is very much akin to that as well. So every day we all come to Island Creek with this kind of dual mission of, you know, in the system in which we live, you have to be able to, you know, make money to thrive, but also, you know, to create this kind of suite of benefits in the process for the coastal economy, for the environment, for the food system. You know, by way of background, you know, Island Creek is obviously, as I mentioned, a farm that is at the heart of what we do. It's the core of everything. It is still very much a substantial presence in our financial picture. It's not just an ornament. You know, the farm is a big part of it. We also have a distribution company selling the oysters directly to chefs all around the country. It sounds like a simple thing, you know, cut out the middleman and go direct to from the source to the end user. But in the wild and woolly world of seafood, it is actually pretty unique. And there's not a lot of firms that do that. And that's both because of this kind of tradition and, you know, on the negative end of that, some kind of entrenched norms and behaviors, but also because seafood supply chains are complex. So that distribution aspect of the business is a lot of what we do. but also reaching out to consumers, you know, because when we started telling that story to magazines and newspapers and chefs and people in restaurants, there was this tremendous need for people to participate more deeply. So a lot of what we do is trying to ingrain shellfish and oysters in people's, a little bit more in people's everyday lives. So we've kind of picked up on this narrative that, you know, in the beginning of the 20th century, oysters were ubiquitous. There was, you know, the saying goes that there was an oyster cart or bar on every corner of New York City and Boston and some of these coastal entrepôts. And then when the wild stocks declined because of a combination of overfishing, water quality deterioration, and a couple other factors, that kind of culture of eating oysters went away. And what we found as, you know, going back a decade now to when we really first started having our big crops, that with the introduction of this technology to be able to grow the oysters, to breed them in a hatchery and create seed and then keep an inventory of them, it not only worked for the fishermen who were kind of converting into farmers, but it also awoke that kind of latent sleeping demand and that presence of shellfish in the, our kind of, particularly here in New England, in our cuisine and gastronomy. So we've been able to capitalize on that, and that's really kind of what we've ridden to the point where we are now. And it's funny that, you know, the oyster itself, because it is so geographically tied to the place from whence it comes, you mentioned wine, Aaron, and it's a great analogy, the different environmental factors at each of these sites have such a major influence on the final product, how it tastes, how it smells, how it looks, that they, in a lot of ways, are the perfect product to be a vehicle for storytelling. Mm-hmm. It's hard to approach an oyster list or a wine list or something like that without wanting to know more about the story. And that's been a big part of kind of what's brought us to where we are.
Yeah, so I believe it's called Merroir when it comes to the ocean, so the terroir with the wine, right? And what I find from seeing what you guys have created, and it's surely that you've curated and cultivated much of this excitement and enthusiasm behind this, is that you continue to innovate, and that innovation happens obviously within the business infrastructure, as you mentioned, vertically integrating your supply chains. You also have restaurants of Row 34, Island Creek Oyster Bars, a new one up in Portland, Maine called The Shop, which are all wonderful and hold at the highest degree. But when you go in there, you recognize that you've taken it even a degree further, where we go to Napa and you recognize there are different vitis, different grape types, there are different regions that come up, different process, aging styles, and there are those terroirs associated. But with oysters, you get to a point where it's even 5 miles up and down the coast, and it's a completely different oyster that you see grown and cultivated based off of the practice that you've evolved. So I think that's an interesting way of then queuing this up, because Duxbury is a very unique place to be growing out. You operate about a dozen acres of production in Duxbury Harbor. Is that correct at this point?
Yeah, more or less. There's some over in Plymouth as well. Okay. Another 10 acres over there.
So, you know, it's a unique waterway to be growing out this ocean farm, this new American farm. And that's kind of an interesting term when we start talking about looking at seafood production, because much of what we think of fisheries is going out and mining, not giving back to the ocean. But what you're creating is really a regenerative approach to the future of food, of giving back to the ocean, putting these bivalves back in, cultivating them, and then developing a supply chain of desirability associated to it. So you've been involved in a project now within Duxbury of engaging the Duxbury local folks in trying to capture what once was a research center at Battelle. And recently there's been a conversation about how to get more individuals into their food systems, and part of that's agrotourism, part of that is engaging them where their food comes from, know their farmer. But you guys took it even a degree further. It seems like you were able to engage that community where they're able to be involved in the conversation, John, that they had a vote. They had a vote to look at this location in Duxbury Harbor, a highly desirable spot, which the other group that was interested in this location wanted to build out high-rise condos for many of the people to retire in Duxbury. And there's a lot of pressure to keep working waterfronts in action, but there's a lot of pressure to keep people have these beautiful locations going. Right. What I've seen, at least maybe from a fly on the wall type perspective, seeing what Island Creek was able to do to engage the Duxbury locals, to be engaged in the conversation, to further this, and to keep the new American farm operating to a point where they had a town vote and it was a 4-1 vote that wanted Island Creek to have this center of excellence around shellfish production and a permanent site to keep this new American farm operating in their local community. So what can you share, Chris, with your terrestrial brethren who are fighting to keep the new American farm going, and also ocean farmers, about that process and where we can continue to get consumers, town folk, people within the industry engaged that this is not linear perspective. We need to have a circular perspective of where our food comes from, that it affects all of us.
Yeah, so there's a lot wrapped up in that.
It's just one question, yes or no.
But I can definitely, I can condense it. Again, oysters are this incredible thing. When I have these kind of retrospective conversations, I often walk away thinking that I really had very little to do with any success that has been had on behalf of Island Creek or this industry. The oysters themselves are, they practically jump out of the water and sell themselves because of all they have going for them. And pitching that message in the early stages was critical. And it's one thing to pitch it, as we've talked about, to, say, a millennial consumer that, lives in one of these urban hubs and is going out and eating them at a restaurant. But to trace the supply chain back to the origin is something that is very important, because those are the people, the communities where these farms are located, the people and the families involved with growing them, and that are neighbors, and they have a bigger stake in this than almost anybody. Hmm. And we work with the distribution company works with about 100 other farmers now in the area, and when we work with them, often what we're doing is flipping that "know where your food comes from" slogan on its head, because as a farmer and someone who lives in a farming community, it's very important to them to know where their food is going. So looking at that kind of circular and supply chain holistically is very important. One of the things that we've tried to do as an industry over the years is to pitch this to the people in those communities, because an oyster cleans the water by filtering nitrogen and particulate matter out of it. It enhances turbidity, which allows plants to grow. You have better oxygen. Fish habitat, emerges around these farms. They're a keystone species. They're also good for you. And the farmers that grow them, can actually make a profit doing it, which a lot of agricultural commodities in this country are not profitable. So it has this incredible message going for it. And how do you take that and turn it on its head in a way and come to someone who, say, owns a very expensive piece of real estate abutting one of these farms and explain to them why that's valuable? Hmm. And that's been a long process. And there's been, in the beginning, there's a lot of, the catchphrase NIMBY, not in my backyard. Someone just paid, made a multi-million dollar investment in one of these real estate parcels, and they hear there's going to be a farm in there. In their viewscape, in what they had considered to be pristine, conserved, ocean water, and they picture, I think, an oyster factory with a smokestack and, a big building and a conveyor belt with oysters just popping out the other end. And in fact, the farms are very diminutive, but really where the rubber hit the road on it was a town like Duxbury. We've been farming there for, as I said, Skip started 25 years ago. They have really picked up as a community on the value mm-hmm. of the product itself and what it's doing, not only out in the kind of global perspective, but also for the town, and having this concept of a town that is, came very close to just being a bedroom community, is now producing this product, 99% of which is consumed, abroad, mm-hmm. Out in the 44 states that we sell to, in different countries, and all of the benefit from it, the environmental benefits, the economic benefits are locked up here in the community. So it was a pretty amazing thing to see when the condo development was proposed. Those same people that 20 years ago were out with torches and pitchforks saying we're never going to have a farm in our view were the same people that said there are 30 million oysters out in that bay and they need to be protected. We can't have, high density housing going in here with all of the negative impacts that it had. So it was, both on a philosophical level, it was rewarding to see, but also on a personal level to see our kind of buy-in to the community pay off after, really decades of effort. Hmm.
You had mentioned earlier that the oysters were very prolific and prevalent throughout the Northeast back in the turn of the century, going into the 19th century, 120 years ago. And in fact, I think Paul Greenberg mentions in his book American Catch that New York, when at the time before we started dumping raw sewage into the East River, they had about 7 trillion oysters protecting the coastline of New York City. So if you look at the effect of that on what that could be, if an average oyster can process and filter about 50 gallons of water a day, they actually act as a reef. They formulate in a reef, and they provide marine habitat for key and marine life cycles, key life cycles within our ecosystems and developing biodiversities. And they also create, through that reef, a storm surge protection. So, Chris, you have been involved in actually taking what you've learned and developed and much of the innovation within Island Creek Oysters and developed this into a next iteration, which is focusing on environmental impact and what these bivalves, what can happen with the future of these as part of an environmental impact as a collective on our waterways, on the living environments where we actually have about 80% of the global population moving towards cities. So protecting these assets through actually using a living reef. And you created, or you're part of the group that created the Shellfish Growers Climate Coalition. So could you talk a little more about that program and what you hope to accomplish with that?
Sure. You know, the policy element of oysters is very important, and it's apropos to the conversation about our new site in Duxbury and that kind of conversion of the community from, fear and loathing to, embracing it. But it really, you have to look at these systems as a whole, and this concept of farming the sea, whether it's shellfish or finfish or what, sea greens, whatever, it really works because of the kind of the holistic impact that it has, but it's also very challenging because it does kind of hit all at once across every different parameter that we have. There's a political element to it, there's a spatial planning element to it, there's an environmental impact, and then a pretty major economic one. So when we look at projects, for instance, with our foundation, or even new projects for the business, we've got farms in New Hampshire and Rhode Island now. We look at it very much through that multifaceted lens. Mm-hmm. What economic impact is this going to have, environmental, et cetera? And we have to be very careful about it because, there's a lot of the term impact gets thrown around a lot. And we had here in Boston, we have a tremendous amount of activity around social impact investing. But the question always has to be, make sure that impact is exactly what you want it to be, and that it's good, and that you evaluate kind of all of these different, the different facets of that. So, obviously, with the environment, the Nature Conservancy, we have gotten together as a group of industry leaders from the West Coast, the East Coast, up and down each, and I think there's 12 farms involved right now, representing probably the majority of the production in the country right now. And we've partnered with the Nature Conservancy to say that we as oyster farmers are very much in the crosshairs of climate change, and we can hold our kind of sign up and say, hey, we're a successful business, we're creating jobs, we're creating jobs in rural communities on the coast that need them, we're creating environmental benefits, we're actually helping to combat climate change. But also, we have a lot to lose if we don't take a more effective approach from a policy standpoint to start reducing the impact of climate change. And to speak specifically about what that is, oysters fix a lot of carbon in their shell. They also filter a lot of stuff out of the water and enhance water quality. But at the same time, they are impacted by the reduction in pH of the oceans that is resulting from carbon that is sunk in the ocean from the turn of the century and the Industrial Revolution that is now emerging in our coastal waters and reducing the pH. But there's also a water quality element where we have a lot of runoff coming from the land into the water, loading it with nitrogen, and algae blooms on it, and then the algae dies and rots. And when it does, it creates carbon and methane, which reduces the pH of the water and the substrate where the shellfish grow. When that pH reduces, the shells of not just oysters, but all shellfish are comprised of calcium carbonate. It's highly soluble in acidic water. So the larvae have trouble kind of going through the metamorphosis where they get their shell. And so this has posed an existential threat to the industry, which is why we've partnered with the Nature Conservancy. But it's also to say that, a lot of people ask us about climate change. And in a lot of ways, it's as farmers, it's, you know, the what we say back to them is, welcome to the party. You know, everybody is freaking out about the fact that the environment and changing the environment can have an impact on their homes, their businesses. And for us, it's always been the case. But this one seems to be the elephant in the room.
What about temperature in terms of water temperature changing?
Yeah, the temperature we've seen, I mean, we're sitting here in Boston today in February and it's almost 70 degrees out. And I've got bulbs coming up at my house when I left this morning. So obviously these kind of the increasing temperature, but more importantly, the erratic temperatures have a huge impact on, you know, things in the natural environment. But again, as farmers, it poses a lot of challenges. So to go from having bitter cold, for instance, in January, where we were out fighting icebergs in the farm and we had huge flooding come through with a storm that actually took gear that we had kind of put on land and deposited it across Cape Cod Bay, to now being worried about the oysters kind of waking up from hibernation and then having the cold plunge. I mean, that type of, you know, erratic variation is something that adds a lot of risk into the equation for us.
The acidification, obviously, being a major concern because of these, if the oysters can't grow out their shells, it changes significantly what your offerings are going to be and what your growth rate is and what your dead loss would be. So it's a pragmatist decision, and it's, I know you guys are also doing it because the heart's in the right place. But to me, that sets up an opportunity to look at these things differently. What we have learned from many of our guests on Sourcing Matters is that the farmers are the first ones, as you mentioned, Chris, to recognize this, that we're seeing drastic change towards circular economies within our food systems. And knowing both the terrestrial production models and also now what's happening within our farming of the ocean, especially when we also take into account, again, that mining of the pulling from the sea and fisheries, boy, that is an opportunity to use our seafood production, especially within our region, which is such a mainstay of our food production models, as an anchor industry for looking at a migration towards a circular economy, which, John, to what's happening within millennials, this idea of systems thinking rather than just, again, that linear perspective of we've got this boundless mass that we can continue to take from and not realize that we have a finite resource within planetary boundaries. Well, that's a sea change that's happening within a generational conversation. And that's why I get enthused, at least to say, you know, many people have a very dystopian mentality about, well, it's all for loss and we're not going to get there. I completely disagree. I think it is exciting when we hear folks in their 30s, like Chris, who's leading an organization. And don't get me wrong, Chris leaves, like, he's got a good life, man. I love this kid. Every time I hear about what he's up to, he's slurping oysters, drinking. No, he's out there making it. But what I love about...
He started a caviar business, too.
So I know.
That's been rough.
And I go to their events, and I'm like, oh, boy. But what I love about Chris here is that he's always pushing the envelope. I mean, he could sit back. How many guys in his age group or in my age group are making a great living from working within sustainable agriculture? And it's very, very few that are doing this. So what an opportunity to take where you've cast yourself ahead and continue to push the envelope and move that forward.
And when I look at what you've done and what Island Creek has done is you've created a category, right? You've created a category and then a brand, and they've turned it into a cause, right? Which are the kind of the three boxes. And I'm sure it happened somewhat kind of organically because that is kind of who you are and where you and Skip and others kind of came from. But those are lessons that hopefully can be applied to other farmers and other kinds of agriculture, both on the coast as well as throughout the rest of America.
That's right. It's a model.
Right.
And, and one of the, you mentioned it is a model here, and it's exciting to see where they've created a cause and they've been able to back it up by a financially soluble business. But Chris is also involved in another project with the Island Creek team, which is their nonprofit foundation, which is focused on finfish and shellfish aquaculture. And they're doing it within developed countries. They're looking at places like Haiti and Zanzibar, which have either been hit heavy by different natural disasters or climate change and sea level rise.
Or politicians.
That's exactly right. Where those, to Chris mentioned earlier, those are a major part of food systems, which we forget. It's Absolutely. This circular perspective of this is as much of a foundation as we've got. So they work on these programs. And what I find exciting and enthusiastic behind these is that when you start to look at the raw numbers of this, that we've got 3 billion people across the globe that are reliant on C protein for their major caloric intake. And as of 2012, about 90%+ of our fisheries were stressed or overstressed. And you look at the UN's expectations, we had Dr. Nabarro on who was telling us that by 2050, we're going to have 9.6 billion people here, and our requirements for that foodstuff is going to probably double. There's no way we can continue as business as usual. And that really comes to bear within our fisheries program, where, again, we're still using a hunter-gathering model for many projects. So the work that they're doing within aquaculture through their nonprofit has multiple facets of why this is exciting. So, Chris, can you talk to us a little bit about what you're doing in Haiti and Zanzibar and why this project is so dear to your heart?
Sure. You know, it's great that you guys mentioned, you know, creating a model and the kind of legacy that that leaves. Systems thinking is something that, you know, we philosophically hold very dear. You know, John, you mentioned at the beginning of the show that, you know, this kind of sea change in millennials' mentality of how they're consuming. And that's something that, you know, is very much a legacy of a conversation that was started before millennials really had that kind of buying power and were able to put their money where their mouth was. So when we think about efforts like the, you know, initiative with the Nature Conservancy or our foundation work or even our business, you know, a lot of that, you know, we look for our kind of passive legacy where this will probably start a conversation that gets carried out, you know, long after we're, you know, retired or, you know, long gone. So, you know, it's very much that kind of mentality with which we approach the work. The foundation in particular is something that we like to try to think of as creating a model, both for, you know, the food systems kind of mission aspect of it, which I can talk more about, but also for small business and saying, you know, we started this foundation when we were doing like $3.5 million of revenue or something. And, you know, thinking about how do we take this tiny little business, but leverage, as all entrepreneurs and business people have, this unique skill set to do some good. You know, we had an overwhelming sense that we were out to change food systems and we weren't going to do it through selling, you know, $5 oysters at Michelin-starred restaurants, much as we like to do that. You know, how do we go and take this amazing kind of lightning rod that we found and bring it to people who probably needed a heck of a lot more than we do. And we started to kind of go abroad and look for these two developing countries and communities that were in need of some help. And the first project that we started was in Zanzibar. We partnered with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution to create a hatchery. Hatcheries are the kind of prerequisite for any kind of farming of the sea. You need to be able to create seed. But what we found was that the population that we were working with were largely hunter-gatherers, as you said, Aaron. They were women who would go out and, on a subsistence level, gather shellfish to feed their families. And the idea behind what we wanted to do was to go out and create this consistent source of seed and supply so that they could both have an inventory and harvest it at will, and not only feed their families, but with that inventory, do exactly what we did in Duxbury, was to have a consistent market presence. When oysters come 2 or 3 times a year and then go away, it's very hard to maintain price and customers and things like that. And they would at times sell some of the surplus product into the market, you know, the local street market or whatever, and they would get some money. But really what we wanted to do is provide a nuanced kind of suite of enfranchisement for this population of women by giving them what was essentially a job based off of something they were already doing. And over in Zanzibar, that's very kind of apropos. But we took that concept and started thinking about where else we could apply it. And we had almost stumbled upon this and looking at all of these ancillary benefits to it. You know, and really what we found were we were alleviating in the development sphere two main afflictions that are the underpinnings for all other development. We're lucky enough to be here in Boston. There's great international development organizations, you know, through Harvard School of Public Health, and Partners in Health is headquartered in Cambridge. So we had a great resource to go and kind of learn about doing this work. But they were, we found, very excited when they found out what we were doing because it alleviated nutritional problems. And so for Partners in Health, for instance, doing healthcare work, it's very hard to do preventative healthcare if you don't have solid nutritional underpinning. And the other piece of it that it alleviated was poverty. So if you can do both at the same time by empowering people to be able to grow healthy food, create a healthy diet for themselves and also an income, that's a powerful thing. And that's really what we've taken to market in other projects like the FinFish project we're doing in Haiti, where we're growing fish. And we have a hatchery and a kind of end-to-end business at this point. It's a nonprofit, but it's modeled after a business that very much resembles our own here in the Boston area.
We try to talk about that. We tell the stories of people that have defined solutions of change. And I have to say, that is a solution of change. It doesn't state the problems. It's not just casting out this. We've got huger problem, big problems, huge issues going across the world. You went out, you took your intellectual property, your knowledge, you turned it into a nonprofit, and you are doing wonderful work. So congratulations on that. And additionally, so, and John, I'm going to turn this over to you because Chris was awarded a 2018 Eisenhower Fellowship. Now, that's a program that identifies and empowers and connects innovative leaders through a transformative fellowship experience and lifelong engagement in a global network of dynamic change agents committed to creating a world more peaceful, prosperous, and just. Now, John, you're the Northeast chapter president of that, chapter leader of that group of the Eisenhower Fellowship Program. You were an Eisenhower Fellow in 2008. Could you comment about what Chris is in store for in his trips to Colombia and Spain, and what the network has meant to you?
Well, and of course, you are a fellow as well, and I'm honored to be your co-host and your sponsor for that fellowship.
Thank you.
As well, which has connected us to Chris a decade after that experience, which completely kind of changed my life. There was, I thought there was virtually no chance that I would actually win the nomination. I was nominated, but go through this process. So I thought really big, and that's what I encouraged, I think, Chris to do. I said, I want to go to China and Korea to study the role of technology in young people. And more than kind of that experience that lasted a couple of months over the course of a year or so, it has been a life-changing experience where there isn't a place that I can think of on the face of this earth that I don't feel like I have a friend through this incredible fellowship. And I've met folks who were fellows the year I was born in the 1960s. We host on a regular basis fellows who are dignitaries and ministers from around the world into Harvard and Cambridge. And to me, it kind of provided a platform and a shared experience with other mid-career kind of professionals who are engaged in the same things that we were. I'm not certainly kind of an expert in food systems, nor was I an expert in a lot of the subjects I've learned so much about, but having kind of shared connections and a shared kind of worldview and platform has been incredible for me, and it's slowly beginning, I think, to have a very positive impact on our hopefully our culture and our economy and thought leadership here in New England with the amazing group of a few dozen fellows that we have here now. And we're incredibly honored that Steve Pagliuca is now the head of the kind of trustee committee in Boston and on the national stage as well.
And Chris, they select 9 to 10 Americans to travel around the world and to execute upon a very customized fellowship program. They pick another 10 from the U.S. that then go to China, their specific program. Then they pick about 20 to 25 international fellows come to the States for 2 months of travel. You get unlimited access to heads of state, corporate leaders, education and academia. It's really a pretty phenomenal opportunity. It was, as John said, it was life-changing and life-altering for myself as well. What are you going to study on your programs, and what's the focus of your programs within South America and then within Europe?
So I'm really excited to have the opportunity, and John was on the committee that interviewed me, so I owe you a big thank you for picking up what I was putting down.
I'll take it in row 34.
Exactly. I didn't bribe him with oysters or champagne or anything like that. So
caviar, though.
Exactly. Right. But I'm headed to Spain and Colombia, as you mentioned, and a lot of what I'm looking at is, you know, a little bit in line with what we do at the foundation, and kind of this whole mission is to figure out You know, we know that aquaculture is a great thing. It can alleviate pressure on wild fisheries. It can grow protein better than almost any other terrestrial source of protein that we know. You know, it can help feed the world. But there are challenges in scaling it, and scaling it in a way that is environmentally responsible and responsible from a human health standpoint. And there's some fundamental challenges that need to be looked at. So a lot of what I'm looking at both in Spain and Colombia is investment. You know, farming and food production in general is very hard to invest in at the production level. You know, you have a situation now where you've got aquaculture trying to scale up. There's a lack of capital to do so. If you look at terrestrial farming, we have a farmer debt crisis in this country right now, where all of the investment goes into downstream supply chain levels. It goes into ag tech, you know, better tractors, robots, better water usage. And those people can make money, but often farmers have trouble capitalizing just the ongoing operation that they have. They're shelling out more and more money for tractors and equipment, but they're not necessarily getting any more money for the food that they're producing. So thinking about investment in food and at that level of, you know, how do you give somebody money and expect it back that's going to go farm? And it's risky, and it's a long kind of time frame until you've got a turnaround on that investment. So Spain is a great example because they've got aquaculture that has existed there for 1,000 years. It's extensive. It's a life in the land. It's polyculture. They grow many species in the same setting. All the way up to the fully industrialized, you know, model that's, you know, finfish cages at sea that's capitalized by Norwegian companies that, you know, are, you know, multi-billion dollar valuations. So you can kind of see this investment and this kind of scale spectrum all in one place. Colombia is particularly interesting from a little bit more of the context of that systems thinking holistic lens that we were thinking about, because Colombia is in a unique position. It has incredible biodiversity. It's one of the most biodiverse countries in the world. It has also had a long history of strife, mostly due to disenfranchisement of the rural population. Recently, the FARC rebels have laid down their arms. There's been a Nobel Peace Prize issued. There's this incredible process underway. And aquaculture can play an incredible role in rural development. I already mentioned it here in the local context. Think about a place like Maine with a struggling coastal economy. You know, aquaculture is an amazing thing for them. It can also play a role in Colombia because at the end of the day, if Colombia is going to create sustainable peace, they have to do so through providing opportunity for the rural poor campesinos, but also for all of these thousands of you know, former rebel fighters who are now trying to re-enter society. And how do they do that? So I'm really excited to go to Colombia and see, you know, with my little aquaculture flag, you know, how can we help?
Well, Chris, we're excited to have you within the network and to continue to learn more. Where can our listeners learn about what you're doing with Island Creek Oysters and then the Island Creek Oysters Foundation?
So you can go on the web is the easiest way, islandcreekoysters.com, and you can get to restaurant websites, the foundation website, everything through there. But also, you know, we have created a consumer platform, so you can go into one of our restaurants in the Boston area, the shop, as you mentioned, up in Portland, Maine, and soon, upcoming for this summer, down in Duxbury at this Battelle lab that we've taken over, we'll have farm tours and, you know, a raw bar down there. And we take great pride in educating all of the staff at all these places to be able to kind of spread the message. So hop onto the web or, you know, go into any of our outlets and just ask.
Like what we've seen in Napa, the effect of agrotourism and wine tours keeps a customer for life and helps with developing testimonials to the value that you're actually putting out there. So congratulations. And John, could you share with our listeners, first of all, they can see you often on Morning Joe, but could you share your Twitter handle with folks, because you're very active on, I guess, with servicing the needs of the millennials, you have to be on Twitter often, but could you share your Twitter handle and any other information that our listeners can find you at?
Thank you. The Twitter handle is at Della Volpe, DellaVolpe. The company is Social Sphere, socialsphere.com, and all of the research that we produce on behalf of our students at Harvard is available at the IOP website, which is harvard.iop.edu.
Well, John Della Volpe, my co-host, which I hope you'll come back again to be a co-host. You're more than welcome at any point. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
And Chris Sherman, thank you very much for participating. We really appreciate you taking the time and educating us on what's happening within the New American Farm.
Thanks to you both for being interested. It was a great session.
Thanks.